Welcome to Studio 2 on a Thursday. I'm Cherry Gray.
And on a Thursday, I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Cherry, the show today I would describe as a little something for everybody.
Yeah.
We're all over the map today. So we're starting in this segment, at the end of this segment, talking to the Philadelphia Inquirer's Rosa Cartagena about the Morton Cranial Collection. You might have heard about this. It's been held at the Penn Museum since the 1800s, and it was collected very unethically. These were human remains that were used to try to build racist scientific theories. Penn has held them for decades, and they're working now to repatriate and to respectfully bury some of these remains, but not everyone's happy with how that process is playing out. Then segment two, Cherry. Big shift.
Yep.
We're talking about tea.
Yep, we got some cups here.
We got some we can clink our cups. There's a Bryn Mawr chemistry professor, Michelle Franzel, who wrote a book, a lovely book, about the chemistry of tea. And she deigned to suggest that it might be helpful to put a pinch of salt in your tea.
Starting an international controversy.
The Brits are up in arms. So we said, Michelle Franzel, come into our studio, Studio 2, pour us some cups of tea, talk to us about the chemistry of tea. Defend your salt in tea
yourself.
Claim. We also want to hear like what you think about tea, how you think tea should be brewed, your favorite cups, maybe your questions about tea, because Michelle knows everything. And I'll also warn folks, there is a high probability of wordplay in this second
segment.
Maybe
a couple puns.
Spill the tea, not my cup of tea, pot kettle black. It's all on the
all
table.
There.
And
all
then
there.
Third segment is about a new PBS kid show called Lila in the Loop. Very excited about this program because although it is not technically set in Philadelphia, it is set in a Philadelphia-like city. And the creators are in the studio in South Philly called Mighty Picnic. And so we talked with the creator and the executive producer, and it was a really fun conversation. And you'll get to hear that later in the show.
Yeah. And by the way, get your tea questions in. You can email us, studio2@whyy.org. Our number is 888-477-9499. Now, if you're in the middle of your lunch, here's my disclaimer. Don't take that next bite because the details of our big story for today to kick off our news roundup.
Disturbing.
A little disturbing. Yes. And many of you have probably heard about that grisly killing in Bucks County where a man allegedly beheaded his father and then posted a graphic video to YouTube where he displayed his father's severed head and ranted about the federal government. Well, police say 32-year-old Justin Moan killed his father Tuesday night in the family's home in Levittown. He was arrested hours later at a National Guard training center about 100 miles from his home. Moan actually referred to his father by name in that video, calling the retired civil engineer for the Army Corps of Engineers a traitor and said that he was glad he was dead. His mother, she found her husband's body in the bathroom. The video he posted, Avi, was online for about 5 hours. It was viewed 5,000 times before it was taken down. By the way, Justin Moan's channel had been terminated because the website had violent extremism policies and that his site had violated those policies.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah.
Yeah. And by the way, Moan is facing a number of charges, including first degree murder and abusing a corpse, as well as other crimes.
Yeah, we talked about this before the show. Do we want to talk about this?
Do we want to talk about this?
Do we want to give any sunlight to this? It's obviously a very disturbing case, but I do think there is one angle that's broader that is something that we can discuss, which is content moderation on these social media platforms. You heard it in the national newscast. You heard it all day yesterday, Capitol Hill, that big hearing about sort of what are the responsibilities of these social media giants, these platforms, when it comes to content moderation. This video was taken down, but it was up for 5 hours.
5,000 views. That's a lot of people who saw this. Yeah.
And the question, of course, is reasonably, how quickly can these companies catch violent content like this and take it down without violating the spirit of sort of free exchange and free information? And I don't have the answers to that, but of course this case brings that to light.
Yeah, and YouTube, of course, used AI, they use human moderators as well. They took down millions of videos over the past year, but this one made it through.
Right. And what should we expect? What can we reasonably expect? We're all sort of marching off into the future with this. And I don't know if we even know what the brakes on this system should look like, mm-hmm. still to this day, and even though YouTube's been around for a while.
Yeah, something needs to be done, and folks are stepping up, or at least talking about it.
I don't want to give them too much credit yet. Mm-hmm. We will turn to something far more pleasant,
yes.
Cherry,
yes.
which is that tomorrow Philadelphia turns 170 years old.
Aww.
And I know what you're thinking. You're saying, wait a second, Philadelphia is not 170 years old. It was founded in the 1600s. It's far older than that. But here's what you didn't know, maybe. For about the first 170 years of Philly's existence, starting in the 1680s, the actual city of Philadelphia was pretty much just what we call Center City today. It was mm-hmm. William Penn's Greentown, that little cluster of streets between the rivers and then between, you know, Vine Street and South. Then in 1854, this thing called the Consolidation Act was signed, and Philadelphia County became Philadelphia City. Mm-hmm. And it basically became the city we know today, with the borders we know today, with some minor alterations since then. So 1854 is really when Philly became Philly. February 2nd, 1854. That happens tomorrow.
That is pretty cool. But what stood out to me, Avi, is that when Philly, as we know it, was created, the Democrats did not run the city. The Whigs did. And they were against this broadening of what is Philadelphia because they felt the Democrats would take over. Fast forward 170 years, who's in charge?
Well, the Republicans had a lock on the city in between. But the Whigs, yeah, sorry.
I had to throw that in there.
Whig dominance of Philly is no more. I do want to shout out, first of all, J.J. Tizu, who you might know that name. He does these walks around the city of Philadelphia, and he's become kind of well known for this. And he suggested this topic to us via email.
That's pretty cool. Thank you,
J.J. It was a really nice suggestion. But also, he has more walks coming up. Some of them are sold out, but if you go to his website, you can sign up for one of those walks. I'm told they're very interesting.
That's kind
of
cool.
And one of the reasons, Cherry, that they decided to expand the city of Philadelphia was because in the parts of the county that were not part of the city, there were these duplicative municipal services, but also people felt not enough policing. And there had been anti-Irish, anti-immigrant riots just outside what was then the city of Philadelphia. And that triggered some of these conversations about expanding the borders of the city.
Fascinating. Philadelphia and the history
There's
of
some
the city.
Layers.
So
There's
layers to it.
Layers to it.
Well,
speaking of tomorrow.
Speaking of tomorrow, because tomorrow's the big, anniversary. But tomorrow's also Groundhog Day, Avi.
It is Groundhog Day.
And there's a lot going on. For one, a New Jersey town will not have a ceremony for its third consecutive year. And snow.
No ceremony.
Yeah. And snow will likely have a comeback. We'll talk about that. So first of all, out in Milltown in Middlesex County, New Jersey, a little bit on the line, probably maybe a little bit outside of our listening area, but still.
We fudged this one a little bit.
They have canceled for the third year in a row their groundhog festivities because of the death of Mel, the groundhog, back in 2022. Apparently, organizers have not been able to find a suitable replacement that complies with state wildlife regulations. So
they can't find a groundhog.
They can't find another Mel, man. But Mel is probably irreplaceable. So there you go.
There's only one Mel.
Locally, though, no matter what, our groundhog, Phil, will forecast on Friday. And, winter may make a very short-term return. Apparently, we could get some snow, which is packing across the country. And Philly, so far, at 8 inches, has had more snow than Minneapolis, which has only recorded 7.3 inches. Can you believe that? We've gotten.
I'm sorting through all of the information you just gave
me.
All right. So no Mel. So Milltown's not having anything.
No.
Punxsutawney's still having their thing with Phil. So we do have a Phil.
We do have a Phil. We don't have a Mel.
We don't have a Mel.
I know that's a lot.
There might be some more snow later in the month is what you're telling me.
But it'll be short.
It'll be short. Okay. So
we probably will not have 6 more weeks of winter, which is what we're talking about.
Okay. I'll tell you what. That groundhog that they have in those PA lottery commercials, Gus, you don't need to replace him. He's animatronic. He lives forever. That could be a possibility.
And that's another groundhog. There's so many groundhogs.
Yeah.
You go. That was cute. You should have seen Avi's face for this one.
Keep on scratching?
Yeah, you had the whole.
I do a pretty good Gus. What can I say? I watch a lot of television. I want to shift now to a far more serious topic. It's got nothing to do with groundhogs, obviously. You may recall back in 2020, the Penn Museum got national attention for its Morton Cranial Collection, which was a collection of over 1,000 skulls that were mostly assembled by an early 19th century scientist to prove white supremacist theories. And this collection was later used for other research. Now, the museum apologized in 2021 for accepting this collection in the first place and then began a process to figure out how to handle the remains respectfully.
The remains of 19 black Philadelphians from the collection were interred in a mausoleum recently, and this Saturday, Penn Museum will hold a blessing ceremony honoring their memory. The event will happen despite backlash from several groups who are raising questions about exactly how much work went into locating descendants. Joining us now is Philadelphia Inquirer reporter Rosa Cartagena. Rosa, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks so much for having me.
Rosa, explain to folks, what is this Morton Cranial Collection? How were these remains and these skulls collected in the first place? And who was Samuel Morton?
Samuel George Morton was a former president of the Academy of Natural Sciences here in Philadelphia. He was based here in the city, and he amassed a collection of more than 1,300, it's estimated, crania from around the world. And this really came from grave robbing and stealing these skulls from individuals, oftentimes from grave sites and burial sites that were including black and other marginalized identities, people with other marginalized identities. And these were, you know, taken from people who were poor, people who at the time couldn't afford their own burials, or, you know, very much stolen here in Philadelphia from grounds in West Philadelphia that held these remains. And those skulls were taken. They were put in this collection in the 1830s and 1840s.
And then Penn acquired this collection
in 1966.
Mm-hmm. And they've spent decades literally trying to make repairs for the damage caused by this collection. Talk about that work and then sort of how the most recent controversy fits in with that.
Sure. So a lot of this has come from public outcry over what was discovered as, you know, the remains of people who were enslaved during their lifetime. Mm. These critics are saying that the museum is not doing this process correctly, that this repatriation process has involved them working with community members on a small group, a small advisory group. These are spiritual and community leaders in West Philadelphia who have worked with the Penn Museum to make this decision about where and when and how to bury these individuals. And that decision came through the courts. They petitioned the Philadelphia Orphans Court, and that was granted. So in this case, you know, their efforts to repatriate the remains really are about moving them to a cemetery and burying them there. However, no, there haven't been descendants that have yet been identified. In this case, these 19 individuals are nameless. They only have information about from Morton, really, about racial background, age, possible conditions that they may have, you know, died from. But outside of that, there has not been, and this is what critics are saying as well, is that there's not been enough time to do sufficient research to know who these individuals are and potentially identify living descendants.
Can I just backtrack a little bit?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So, Rosa, so there's like 1,300 yes. specimen in this larger collection. We have somehow focused now on these 19 who are probably from Philadelphia. And these are the ones that Penn has decided to put in a mausoleum at the Eden Cemetery. How did we get to these 19? Like, why the focus on these 19?
This idea is that the entire collection should be dismantled and repatriated. And the museum is starting locally with the idea that hopefully this would be a process that they would be able to do expediently. The issue here is that there's a concern that they're doing this too fast. They're doing this too quickly because there hasn't been enough research done. And they're also, you know, critics are also saying that there's not much transparency over who's making these decisions.
And who yeah. has been a part of this decision process in deciding what should be done to repatriate?
Yeah, so this Morton Cranial Collection Advisory Group consists of about 14 people. It's changed a little bit since they petitioned the court, but it contains multiple members who are affiliated with Penn, and then it also contains West Philadelphia community and spiritual leaders. So coming from, you know, really trying to represent these constituencies in that neighborhood.
So the critics are saying they haven't done enough work to track down the descendants before making this decision to bury the remains in this mausoleum. But what haven't they done, according to the critics?
Yeah, I think they haven't done enough research into this this question of who these individuals are. And then the other concern is that this is coming from a decision-making body that is really just the museum, an extension of the museum. Mm. That this should be, and they're also saying, you know, in other cases where human remains of enslaved people have been found, that other institutions have done this by giving control over the decision-making to independently organized community groups who then are able to say when, where, and how they should be buried.
But before we wrap up, though, I just want to get a sense of what not done enough means. Like, have they been more specific about what exactly not done enough entails? Like, are there specific avenues they haven't gone down?
Right. Yeah. So the number 19 is actually something that's newer here. And even a couple of weeks ago, this group of volunteer researchers had found that there was the one person whose name they do have, that he has Native American ancestry. And so he's subject to different protections than the remains of people from African descent And in this context, you know, they're saying that they are no longer going to inter, and they did not inter that individual. They're still withholding him at the museum so that he might be available for people to come and potentially claim him.
Yeah. And as we wrap up, I got to ask you, what is going to happen this weekend? Because the remains have already been buried. Mm-hmm. So what is supposed to happen?
So this is an interfaith ceremony. They're going to be at the Penn Museum first, and they will be commemorating these individuals there, and then they will be going to the historic Eden Cemetery. And I think as well, the critics are going to be planning some counter-programming around that.
Okay. Thank you, Rosa Cartagena, arts and entertainment reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, for being with us here in Studio 2.
Thank you.
Coming up next, the chemistry of tea. Make your case for the best way to prepare a cup. Call us 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome on back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfmaner.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Who would have thought, Avi, that a Bryn Mawr chemistry professor could start an international incident over tea? But that is what happened when Michelle Fransel wrote in her new book, Steeped, that adding a few grains of salt to a cup of tea improved the taste. Who knew?
Not the people in the United Kingdom. They were shocked. They were appalled. TV news channels went around asking British tea drinkers what they thought, and pretty universally, they were disgusted by this suggestion. And of course, the fact that this advice came from an American, that probably did not help. We, however, Cherry, are unbiased journalists, and we wanted to get to the bottom of Fransel's claim and learn more about the science of tea, which I have to say is fascinating.
Very fascinating.
So we have Michelle Fransel with us now in studio. She's even brought some tea with her to taste for us. Michelle, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you so much for having me.
And friends, if you are a tea lover, we want to hear from you. What's your favorite tea? Do you have questions about varieties or the health benefits? You can call us or email. The number is 888-477-9499. The email studio2@whyy.org.
All right, Michelle, I don't want to tiptoe around the controversy. Mm-hmm. Let's get right into it. So how did you come up with this idea of, you know, creating a perfect or ideal cup of tea, and how did salt enter into that equation?
So the idea for the book came from a tweet that another chemist posted that said, does the shape of a tea bag matter? And it was between semesters, and I'm like, oh, hey, I wonder what chemists know about the shape of tea bags. It turns out we know a ton about the shape of tea bags.
Oh, really?
And and that got me looking at the chemistry literature around tea. And I wrote a short essay, and just as the pandemic broke, an editor saw it and said, can you turn it into a book? And it turned out, sure, I could turn it into a book. So this is in some ways a pandemic project for me. But the salt comes from an 8th century Chinese manuscript, which talks about how to make the best cup of tea. And it recommends adding a little salt to the water. And I wondered, what's the chemistry behind that? Or is it just, you know, something random? And so I dug into the chemistry literature. It turns out the coffee people knew that the sodium ions block some of the receptors for bitterness. And so you don't perceive the bitterness as much. So that's a hack coffee drinkers have been using for a while.
And it's just a pinch of salt, right?
Oh, like if you can taste, if it tastes salty, it's too much. I've seen these British things where they're putting a teaspoon in. I'm like, I can't imagine that they
could
take a drink.
That's why you guys don't like it.
Right, yeah.
And so I want to zoom out and talk a little bit more about this perfect cup of tea, because there's a lot to it. I mean, and there's so many different elements that I don't think. And I had some tea last night, and as I was, you know, flipping through your book, and I think about, there's so many elements that I think the average tea drinker just doesn't think about.
Right. Well, I didn't think about it either. Even as a chemist and a longtime tea drinker, I didn't think about a lot of these things either. Everything from the temperature of the cup to how the tea was handled and prepared, the difference between green tea and black tea. It was fascinating for me to find out there was incredibly rich chemistry.
And so, yes, the variables involved here, we've got temperature.
Right.
We've got mug.
Yes.
We've got the type of tea.
Yes.
We've got steeping time.
Yes.
We've got other things added, whether
water.
It's a warm milk. The type of water you use.
Right,
can
right.
you talk about water? Actually, that's an interesting part of this. What types of water should we be using in our tea?
So if the water is hard, it's got a lot of ions in it, and that will react with some of the things in the tea. So if I make my tea at the college where the water is incredibly hard.
What does that mean, hard water?
Hard water means having lots of ions like calcium and magnesium in it. And those are ions that like to bind to other things because they have big charges. One of the big ideas of chemistry is opposites attract.
Okay.
So if you've got like a big charge on an ion, it's attracted to other things that are negatively charged. So those magnesium and calcium ions start like latching on to stuff. And that's chemistry. And the chemistry it latches onto changes the color. It's like I can tell you if my cup of tea was made at the college or at home just by looking at the color of the cup.
Huh. Wow. And one of the other things you talk about is water temperature. Apparently, a lot of us mess that up.
Oh, right. We would like to use the right temperature. So for black tea, that means water at the boil. So 212 degrees Fahrenheit. For green teas and some other teas, you want a little cooler, just below the boil. I learned from a Buddhist abbot how to take the tea and dump it between two different tea bowls to cool it off a little bit.
Whoa, okay.
These are tricks. tricks of the trade right here.
This is how to hack your cup of tea. The whole book is really about how to hack your cup of tea.
If you want to hack your way into this conversation, give us a call. We're talking with Michelle Frantzel, professor of chemistry at Bryn Mawr College and author of Steeped, The Chemistry of Tea. I think you guys know, studio2@whyy.org. Mm-hmm. That's our email address. Okay, you must have been stunned by the reaction across the pond. And let me read a few quotes, and I'm not to embarrass you, but just to give people a sense of how some British tea drinkers felt. Quentin Letts of the Daily Mail said it was like the worst kind of pre-operation laxative. That was his description of the little salt in
laxative.
The tea. A Brighton tea drinker said tea's pretty spot on by itself. It doesn't need to be changed. The American Embassy in the United Kingdom said, we want to assure the good people of the UK that the unthinkable notion of adding salt to Britain's national drink is not official United States policy and never will be. However, I have to say, another British journalist, Malcolm Brabant, said, I feel like I'm a traitor, but it's not too bad. Give me a sense of what it was like to see this thing just kind of explode online.
It was crazy. I went into work on Wednesday morning, and there was, you know, one sort of request from a journalist about the tea, and then by the time I reached the college, I had a request for a comment responding to that U.S. Embassy statement. I'm like, what U.S. Embassy statement?
About me? Do you have the right professor?
Right. Do you have the right professor? Do you have the right stuff? You know, there's a lot of stuff going on in the world, and somehow tea did not seem like could rise to the top. So it was really wild. And it's kind of fun to see people talking about the chemistry a little bit. And, you know, as a lifelong lover of chemistry, it's nice to see it getting some good press.
One of the interesting things you said in the beginning of your book is that there's typically coffee people and then tea people, and most people are not both.
Right.
I drink coffee in the morning, tea at night.
Ah,
is so that, yeah, like, so I'm wondering, why is that? What is it about the personality differences between coffee and tea drinkers?
Coffee has a lot more caffeine in it than even the strongest tea. So I think if you really want that caffeine hit in the morning, you want your cup of coffee in the morning. I find coffee too bitter. Maybe I should try some salt in my coffee in the morning.
We could do that.
Mm-hmm. But you're like my son who wants his coffee in the morning and his tea in the afternoon.
Yeah, very interesting.
It's kind of, that can be like a nice gentle slope into the evening.
And I do caffeine-free teas.
Before we get to some tea tasting, though, there is some really interesting stuff in this book just about caffeine in general. And one of the things that you point out, and I did not know this, is that the way caffeine interacts in your system, its half-life, can be dependent on what you're eating that same day. Is that right? Like broccoli will help get it out of your system, but carrots won't? I mean, I was trying to make sense of this.
So it has to do with how caffeine gets out of your system, which happens in the liver. And there are certain enzymes in the liver that can be influenced by what you eat. So there are some drugs they tell you not to take with grapefruit juice, because that will keep them from getting cleared out by the liver, and you can get too much concentration. But that works with caffeine, too. I mean, caffeine is the drug in the cup.
Yep.
And so grapefruit will extend the length of time that caffeine stays in your system. And it turns out that broccoli and other things in that kind of cabbage family will reduce it.
So if I'm trying to go to sleep, I don't know how quick acting this would be, but let's say if I'm going to have some tea a little later in the day, maybe have some broccoli or cabbage with
it? Yeah, I don't think it goes quite that fast.
Oh,
I think
darn.
Right.
So have to plan ahead.
Right, that would probably really set the British off by saying you need to have, you know, broccoli with a cup of tea. That would be the end.
I'm sorry. Don't listen to this, London.
Yes, and one of the things you talk about in the book is that you say a cup of tea is essentially a drug delivery system. And while the primary drug is caffeine, people do drink teas for medicinal uses.
Sure.
And there's a long history of that.
Tea was originally a medicinal beverage. It was not recreational or, you know, something that when drank, you know, with a meal. It was really a medicinal beverage. And human beings and primates have been using plants medicinally since before we were human. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the thing that I was really fascinated to find out as I researched for the book, that this is incredibly old chemistry.
Yeah. And the follow-up to that is, humans got the idea from watching animals?
Yeah.
That was very fast.
Like, oh, yeah.
We were watching animals sort of drink the water of plants and decided to make tea.
Right, yeah. I mean, it's sort of, people chewed on plants, right? Animals chewed on plants, people chewed on plants, and then someone got the idea, well, we don't need to get it wet by chewing on it. We can, you know, put this in, you know, to steep somewhere else. So it's really old chemistry.
So I want to do something real quick before we bring on a caller. And this person's been screened. They're not an angry British person. Mm-hmm. So that you're safe.
Thank
but,
you.
But while we bring that caller on, I want to start pouring some tea. So,
what do I have here
in my hand?
So what you have in there is a pu'er tea, which is a black tea, but it's made using a mold. So there's that black mold that you sometimes see on onions. And that's the mold that does the work of turning that tea into a nice dark tea. It's really smooth and not astringent.
It looks lovely. What a mold. Great color.
You said mold?
Oh, yeah. It's done during mold. Chemistry, it's like mold and cheese.
Mold and cheese.
So should we smell the tea like we do wine?
Yeah. There's all these beautiful scents that go with it, some of which are like shown to be...
I almost get like a bread scent from that, like a yeasty, like just a comforting scent. Should I put a pinch of salt?
You can try a pinch of salt. That's pretty not bitter, so the salt may not change it very much.
Okay.
It's like this is almost like a full body tea.
Yes.
Interesting.
Some of those are aged for like 10 years or more.
And this is salt. So I just
think that's delicious. Okay, now I'm going to bring in this caller, as I promised. This is Donnie. She taught kids about the science of tea. What are the chances? Donnie, you're on Studio 2. What is your question or comment?
Well, it's just a comment. I was saying that I had middle schoolers, and we talk about the science of many different things, but I taught them the science of tea, and we called it a positivity.
Oh, fabulous.
And we had people come in just to talk about self-esteem afterwards, but it was a good opportunity to teach kids about tea, and we brought in all different kinds of chocolate-infused tea and oolong tea, and just talked about the oxidization of it, and Just kind of put it on a middle school level and had a good time with it.
Thank you, Donnie. Great. On to the next generation.
Can I
like it.
Can I ask a question based on that? That's a great comment from Donnie. And, you know, this kerfuffle, and we're having fun with it, is purely fun, and it's a distraction. But it's become, I think, a vehicle to talk with everyday people about chemistry. And what do you hope people take away from these conversations and from your book?
Well, I hope that people realize that there's an incredibly intricate world that we can't see. So when you hold that mug in your hand, there are as many molecules in that mug of tea as there are stars in the universe.
That's incredible.
So there's a whole universe right there in your hand. So that's one thing I'd like people to know. And the other thing, it's nice to know how the world works. And so the book has four big ideas of chemistry that you can use in other contexts to see how the world works.
I absolutely love that. And do you have a green tea in here?
I do, underneath the green tea cozy.
And while we do this, we have a caller who wants to know.
I'm going to pour some green tea.
Talking
here.
About green tea, but let's pour first.
Okay.
And then we'll bring the caller in who has a question.
And this is Mike who wants to talk about, I believe, about temperature of tea. Mike, we've got you now on Studio 2 as we drink some green tea. What is your question or comment?
Well, thanks. I probably have a pot of green tea a day, and I vary different varieties. But what I wanted to ask the author, and I love the show, thank you, is so a Japanese sencha, for instance, the bag will say 1 minute, steep it for 1 minute, I think that's 175. And then some other green teas are typically 2 to 3 minutes. And I can play with that, but I want to get your opinion on how much different does it matter if it's 2 or 3 minutes longer than it calls for, and what happens?
That's a fascinating question. Can you address that, Michelle?
I can. So different compounds in the tea come out faster than others. Caffeine comes out pretty fast. And so in that 1 minute, you get probably a lot of the caffeine that's in that green tea. If you let it go a little longer, you get more antioxidants out and more sometimes of the bitter and astringent compounds. And you just need to play with the time to find what works for you. Most green teas are steeped at a lower temperature, which also changes kind of the composition of what you're getting out.
How does that, the steeping time, impact the flavor of the tea?
So generally, as you let tea steep longer, it gets more bitter and more astringent.
So if you don't like that bitter, just
take it out.
For this green tea here, I'm sensing more of a sweetness than I typically associate with green tea. And so was that because of something you did in preparation?
It's just the choice of the tea. And so there's an old manuscript that says that the hand of the tea master is what's needed to bring out the flavors of the tea. And this is a tea called green snail tea. No snails, promise.
Okay.
I wouldn't mind if it was snails, but I appreciate
the
disclaimer. We bring in snails, then we get the French upset. We don't want to create another international incident.
I want to ask this email from Megan because it's a question I have. Does it make a difference if you put your sugar or honey in with the tea bag, or is it better to wait until after it's steeped? I always put my honey at the bottom of the cup, then put the tea bag in the water. Have I been doing this wrong?
No, it's okay to put that sugar or sweetener in first. I tend to wait until the end because otherwise, you know, in case I over add a little sweetener. But that will really not affect the chemistry of the steeping in the cup.
Okay.
Milk. We have not really addressed milk yet, but this was another thing that you talked about, and I do think got some pushback on that as well. Not as much with the salt, but milk, what's the best way to incorporate it, and what's it doing for that cup of tea?
So there's a couple things. So there's a whole brouhaha generally in Britain. Sorry about that.
I love all the brouhaha.
I promised puns, and we're delivering.
There's a pun. But about whether milk goes in first or last. And it really makes not a whole lot of difference whether you put it in first or last if you're pouring brewed tea from a pot in. If you're going to make your tea, this is one where, Terry, you don't want to put the milk in before you brew the tea. You want to do it at the end because it'll lower the temperature. And because generally it's cold.
Because it's cold, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
And sometimes tea it's hot, it's almost at the boiling point, and it can curdle the proteins in the milk, which some people don't care for.
I've had that problem with coffee at times, too.
Yeah, and so if you warm the milk up or if you let it sit on the counter for a little bit, you can make that be less likely. That really upset the British. cold milk is the whole point, they say. And, you know, the best cup of tea is the best cup of tea you're enjoying. So if that's good.
And something tells me you enjoy upsetting the British. I just feel that.
No.
Michelle, I'm getting that off you.
No,
I'm trying not hard. My oldest son lives in London, and I think he's now afraid to tell anyone who his mother is.
Well, look, upsetting the British is a Philadelphia tradition. Okay, so I just want to bring in a couple more emails. Here's one from Ruth, who says the best teas, in Ruth's opinion, are Darjeeling and chocolate macaroon. I don't even know
this
what
is
that
chocolate macaroon.
I think of chocolate macaroon as something that you maybe eat with tea, but I guess it's a type of tea. And then
this is
Marisol,
a good question.
And I think Marisol's commented before. I like Marisol. Mm-hmm. Marisol asks, loose leaf tea or bags, what do you think?
Oh, my preference is for loose leaf tea. Mm-hmm. You really get much more contact between the water and the tea leaves, so you get out all these beautiful floral compounds. So all the tea I brought you today got made with loose leaves. But on the other hand, most people use tea bags because it's really convenient. And if I'm, you know, out somewhere and tea bags are what there is, that's what I'm going to use.
And as we pour our next tea.
Yeah, so what's this one here? I'm just.
That one, I think, is
jasmine?
Yeah, jasmine.
Oh, nice.
I did label them.
And as we pour this, I have to ask you, how do you. I started with loose leaf for the first time recently. What is the best way to make sure? I mean, how much should you be putting it in the little infuser? Like, is there a way to do it wrong? Because I always have things floating in my water.
Right. So you want the really
so
great.
Floral.
Oh yeah, this is incredibly floral.
This is very
smells
fragrant.
Amazing.
Right, even just breathing it just makes you feel good.
This is jasmine.
I either use jasmine or rose in the afternoon just because it makes my office smell nice. But the key to the infuser, Cherry, is to find one of these ones that has I didn't bring one in to the studio with me, but that has very tiny holes in it. Laser perforated stainless steel works great. Doesn't add any flavor, and you don't get the little bits in the bottom. Mm-hmm. The thing you don't want to use, I brought my cutest infuser, which is looks like a yellow submarine, but the trouble is it's too small, and the tea leaves don't have any room to expand, and there's tiny holes, so there's not easy passage of the water. So I use an infuser in my mug that's almost the same size as the mug. Lots of space
before
for everything to move around.
We let you go. And sadly, we are coming up on the end of this segment.
I know.
But
this has been fun.
You know that we here in the public media world, we're big into mugs.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of mugs. I don't know if the mugs that we give out are actually the right mugs for drinking tea. What's the right type of mug to best enjoy your tea?
I'm going to say it's one that holds the heat so that it stays warm while you drink it. And often that's a short and stout mug, just like that song you learned in kindergarten about teapots should be short and stout.
I'm a little teapot, yeah.
Yep, absolutely.
Oh.
So the mugs that are sitting here on the table look pretty good to me.
So nice. Our Studio 2 mugs work for tea.
I like
absolutely.
That. I like, so short and stout holds in the heat.
Right, because it has less surface area for the volume.
And Perfect. By the way, I'm going to jam this in. Email from Carol. She says, can you talk about the value of cinnamon in your tea?
There are lots of spices you can put in your tea. And in India, you can find a bazillion different ways to do it. It's great.
That's awesome. Well,
awesome.
Michelle Frantzel, this has just been lovely. And the book is called Steeped, The Chemistry of Tea. It is making waves across the world, as we established. Michelle Frantzel is also a professor of chemistry at Bryn Mawr College right outside Philadelphia. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been great fun.
I love this jasmine tea. And coming up, we'll hear from the folks behind a new PBS kids show inspired by Philadelphia. Stick with us.
With those millionaires, when I take my sugar to tea, I'm as ritzy as I can be, 'cause I never take where the gang goes.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Harris.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. That theme song is going to get stuck in my head. On Monday, a new series called Lila in the Loop will premiere on PBS Kids. It follows Lila, a dynamic 7-year-old black girl who lives in a big city with her siblings and parents above the family's diner. She's a relatable, relentless engineer who works hard to solve everyday problems.
And the big city that you mentioned, Cherry, is very heavily inspired by Philadelphia. So, of course, we have to talk to the folks behind the show. We have to do it. It's Philly adjacent.
Mm-hmm.
We sat down with executive producer for Caswell Hyman and the series creator Dave Peth, who runs Mighty Picnic Studios in South Philly. And I started by asking Dave about Stu. That's STU, standing for Something Truly Unique. He is Lila's fantastical blue sidekick.
He's a creature that's totally unique, but he's very literally minded. So he'll do exactly what you ask, no more, no less. So if you ask Stu to pour you some cereal, he will, and he'll keep pouring and pouring and pouring because you didn't tell him exactly how much you wanted or when to stop. So together, they solve problems in everyday life. They, you know, build with blocks. They make their own toy train to ride in. They help out in the family restaurant together and, of course, make some pretty big messes along the way.
Stu, please pass me the ketchup. Stop! Please, gently pass me the ketchup.
So Stu is very literal and can do things really fast and really efficiently. So he's kind of like a computer,
kinda
right?
That's right. It's kind of like a computer.
And for Caswell, you are the head writer. You're also the executive producer of the show. So what is it like writing these type of problem-solving-based shows in a fun way for kids 4 to 8 years old?
You know, I look for the human story first. Mm. And, you know, things that kids would recognize as something they've dealt with themselves or, you know, something that they're going through. Once I find the story that we can have fun with and also accomplish the learning goals, then we set off and fill in the story.
And Lila is relentless
mm-hmm.
in the episodes that I've seen. It's like Lila starts solving a problem, doesn't quite solve it all the way, and is like, all right, what went wrong here? And she, like, reverse engineers it.
Now we can figure this out. It's just a problem we can solve, right? Right.
Why did you see Lila as a good character to embody those character traits for the kids who are watching?
Well, because she's a girl, you know, and girls get the job done, you know, girls who run the world, girls, right?
Yay.
Hey. And also, you know, there aren't as many women of color yeah. in the whole computer.
Yeah, science
STEM
and tech careers. That's
careers.
Right.
And so Lila is designed to encourage that, you know, encourage girls who look like her to think about doing that kind of stuff, to, you know, take over Silicon Valley.
Start and, with Lila.
Yeah, and I think she is a good example, not only for girls of color, but for any girl, because she's funny, she's mm-hmm. fun, she's welcoming and warm, you know, her whole family is. And so I think that's she's someone that all kinds of girls and boys can look up to.
Yeah, and I'll add on, she also makes mistakes, you know? She's not perfect. Mm. She's not a morning person, as we find out early in this series, which we all can relate to. And kids need to know it's okay not to be perfect, whatever that may mean. You got to just try and be okay to make mistakes and just go ahead and try again. You really can't solve any problem if at the first couple bumps you just sort of throw in the towel. You know, you got to be willing to look closer and sort of go part by part and really, you know, debug, you know, to use the computer science term. Like, where's the source of the problem?
Yeah.
And you all deal with ethical issues, too. And I'm thinking about AI. And a lot of students are tackling the use of artificial intelligence in classrooms. Talk about sort of wrapping in some of those ethical issues, like, into the problem-solving lessons that you teach.
Well, there's an episode in Lila where her sister gets a picture drawn mm-hmm. that she asks Stu to draw. And she just asked him as an example of, you know, what she might do. And then by accident, that drawing is taken and submitted to her teacher. And she has to, you know, has the dilemma because everybody loves it. So does she tell them that she did it or does she tell them that Stu did it? You know, and I think that's important in this day and age of AI to, you know, not do it the quick and easy route and have the computer draw, make your art or write your essay, but actually do the work yourself.
So, David, you know, instead of just STEM problems, it's life problems.
That's right. That's right. And I think the message of the show, even beyond that episode, is that we don't have to accept technology that we're given. You know, kids now, they're the folks who are going to be making the tech in the future.
It seems like in this show for Caswell, you guys are trying to give them a sense of their power and their responsibility.
Yeah, I think it's a sense of the power and responsibility not only of the kids, but of the family as a whole.
Yeah.
You know, for us to put down the tablets and, you know, turn away from the phones for a while and do things together. So, you know, we encourage them to play together, to have fun together, to create their own games, you know, that they can play together, because it's important not to lose the connection with your family and be off looking at your phone all the time.
Yeah, that's right. You know, some of our favorite episodes, I think, are, or they go, you know, on a scooting and bike riding together. They bake together.
Camp together.
Camp together, exactly. And all that is, you know, it's encouraging that same connection that Kaz just spoke about.
So this is an animated show. You know, there's a lot of Philly scenery in there. How do you sort of tie all that in? I know you have a team. But right. Explain the process for us.
Well, when we were looking at location designs, for example, and you have to pull together some pictures, you know, what's it going to look like? What are the animators going to pull from? And so we drew a lot of reference points from Philly architecture. You'll see a lot of row homes in the series. Lila and her family live in the apartment building upstairs from their family restaurant, and her best friend Everett Fan lives at an apartment across the hall, and his family has a hardware store on the bottom floor next door. So we have this like dense neighborhood, all different kinds of folks living together, a lot of family run businesses.
Very Philly.
Exactly. This is what feels like Philly to me. And some small touches you'll see in one episode, if you can find it, there's a Philly soft pretzel in that classic shape. So those who know will know that's a Philly
look
specialty.
For the Easter
yes,
eggs.
That's right.
I want to ask you about Stew. Stu, it's sort of, I guess, maybe easy for me as an adult to see him as like a proto-computer type character. But the truth is, like, it's not really explained what Stu is, where Stu comes from. And I want to ask about that dynamic when you're presenting something to children. Because on one hand, sometimes children, they want to know everything. Why? Who? Mm-hmm. What is that? Where does it come from? But they're also really good at filling in the blanks with their imagination. So how do you kind of play with that line with a character like Stu, who is something?
Well, we show kids a character that's fun and empathetic and always willing to help, but then you get to make up the rest of it yourself, you know? People and characters ask Lila, is he a cat? No, he's a stew. Is he a wombat? No, he's a stew, because stew is something truly unique. And so the audience has the space to create who they think Stu is or where they think Stu came from. And he's pretty fun to draw, too. So,
and you guys incorporate kids from our area into the show as well. Dave, can you talk about how Philly kids are involved?
That's right. Yeah, when we were recording our theme song, which was composed and performed by Divinity Rocks, we reached out to a local Philly public school, Fannie Jackson Coppin School in South Philly, and invited some students there to take part in recording the theme song. So Divinity came down, and we recorded the kids, you know, singing and stomping and shouting. And you can hear the voices now in the theme, and it just made it, it's wonderful to hear them in there.
Lila in the loop, round and round with Stu. Now you can jump in too with Lila in the loop. Got a big idea? Step it out, break it down. Now put it all together, loop around.
Yeah, and kids also submit their artwork.
That's right. Yeah, every episode starts with a mural, another very Philly touch, right, where you see the title of the episode, and behind it is kid art on the wall in Lila's world, and that was submitted by a kid, some kids here in Philly, some from across the country.
That is Dave Peth, creator of Lila in the Loop and founder of Mighty Picnic Production Company in South Philly.
Woo-hoo!
Thanks for joining us, Dave.
Happy to be here.
You also heard for Caswell Hyman, executive producer and head writer of Lila in the Loop, also an author and actor. For Caswell Hyman, thanks for being with us on Studio 2.
My pleasure.
Oh, yeah. We are
jamming.
That is
a very catchy song. So catchy.
Lila in the Loop premieres on WHYY TV 12 this Monday, February 5th. Enjoy it with a properly brewed cup of tea. Mm-hmm. You can also watch on the PBS Kids app.
Looking forward to that launch. And that, friends, is it for our show today. Download us wherever you get your podcasts and be sure to rate and review. Our producers are Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Al Banks engineered today's program. Joan Isabella is our audio general manager. From Studio 2 at WHYY here in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg, my pinky up, sipping this tea.
I'm Avi, rate and review, Wolfman Arendt. Thank you for joining us. We will see you next week.